gentlemen, program cards for this evening's performance are available at all entry points to the auditorium. Thank you.
Good evening, Raymond. How are you?
I'm well, and yourself, Tomas?
I'm well, sir. Very well.
So, here we are. It's a Mozart Fest this evening. And here's a question for you, Tomas.
Yes.
When you think about it now, what can be said about him that hasn't already been said? We know the story. The childhood prodigy, outrageous talent, shockingly early death.
For me, that is really what the whole Mozart story is now. The most important things we think about him is how much Mozart there is. I mean, Mozart.com, Amadeus.org, every film, every book you turn around, shelf after shelf, website after website.
But for instance, Moss, here's the thing now. I'd say for all those music anoraks out there, I might still be able to come up with a pub quiz question.
If anyone can, you can, Ray.
But here we go, Moss. We know him as Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart, but he was baptized as, wait for it, Johannes Chrysostomus Wolfgangus Theophilus Mozart.
But he's, you know, there's a lot more than pub quiz.
He had an interesting life.
He had an extraordinarily interesting life. And, I mean, we really, I know we all think we know a lot about Mozart, but do we know? Do we know the real thing? Did he really die in poverty? Was he really a child prodigy? I mean, is, you know, how much of this is true? How much of it is the story?
Well, I think some of it is just, it's there's a lot of mythologizing has gone on there. But I think there are basic facts we can hang on to, shall we say. I mean, the most extraordinary early life, being taken all around Europe by his father with his sister. They performed as a trio, Mozart on keyboard, sister singing, and father playing the violin. But it would count, I would say, today as child abuse, what they went through. For instance, they would arrive at a royal court or whatever, a city, and they would be waiting for patronage, waiting for commissions, waiting to be paid, waiting to have money paid for them, you know?
I suppose what we're really looking at, what I'm really suggesting is that very like all of these Disney stars, you know, so that whole, they're really a stable, you know, Justin Bieber, Miley Cyrus, these people are a stable, and that they're taken out and they're worked at a show when they're five, they're worked at a show, a different one when they're seven, they're dragged around on tours all over America. The same thing is still happening. He was being dragged around on tours, and as soon as they see a little, they see that he's a prodigy, and they think, right, let's get the piano tour out. And hopefully, I suppose, Justin Bieber and Miley Cyrus will end up with some kind of evolution into genius, but I don't know.
I'm not sure, Tomas. I can't see 600 work pieces of original composition coming out of any of the people you mentioned there. But I think it's sad that I can see exactly what you're saying there. These people become a product, and he was a product. He was the child prodigy, and perhaps passed all the way through adolescence without perhaps really growing up as such, because this genius was sustaining him all the way through. And I think, of course, that's now the one-dimensional view that people would have of him, fostered by the film Amadeus. Remember the film Amadeus?
I do. Do you know that was 1984?
Tomas, I was hoping you wouldn't say that.
I'm very sorry. I'm very sorry to mention it. Sorry for your troubles, Raymond.
It was a piece of whimsy, a nice flippant piece of entertainment. But when you think of the one-dimensional way, without any nuance or depth, in which he was portrayed, a laughing jackass at times, you might say, who happened to be able to compose some music of genius, it didn't do his legacy any good. And that it has now almost become his legacy in some respects for some people, that they immediately just think of this, you might say, child man-child.
Kidult, I think, is the word they have these days.
You saw me struggling for the right word. And that's where he's locked into people's minds like that. But when we come to think of this evening's programme, for instance, the violin concertos, which three of which we're going to hear, it's worth just pausing for a moment and looking at the achievement, Tomas. Five violin concertos. Am I allowed to say concerto, or would the language police get on to me for
concerti?
Okay, I'll concede that point, Tomas. But just ponder for a moment and think, we've got a 19-year-old boy, essentially. In 9 months, in one 9-month period from April to December, he composed five violin concertos. It's worth pausing over that. And also, if you read any critiques of it from far more wise minds than mine, but serious musical critiques of it. They talk about it in terms of, you know, the development of his style, the greater maturity, the greater orchestration, and so on and so forth, the greater challenges for the orchestra to play. It's as if they're considering a body of work that was written by over a 10-year period.
Yes.
You know? And this is what I think is fascinating about them, and which should be really interesting to see this evening when we're getting the three. And just to recap, think again. 19 years of age, 5 concertos, 9 months.
I think it is possible, when you look at that, to say, how can they talk about development in this, you know, this period of months in a 19-year-old's life? But then you think about the Beatles. You think about Paul McCartney, John Lennon, and you think about their writing over periods of just 9, 10, 20 months. You know, so you're only looking at a period of less than 2 years from them being mop-top Beatle, Love Me Do, Moon and June writers, to symphonic tone poems that are coming out in 66 and 67 with Sergeant Pepper and so forth. So there is evolution, and we see it again and again. People can do this very quickly, particularly if you're in a society which values you growing up so quickly. Today, you know, a mature 29-year-old kidult is still just feeling their way through it. Whereas there was a time, and it was only 40 years ago, when people felt, you know, by the time you were 25, you were a mature individual, and you should see progress in that. But then, of course, I was just going to come back again
and say that, indeed, you mentioned about them responding to where they were at their moment in time and so forth. I believe that he was very much responding to the milieu in which he found himself. He was in Salzburg, he was working at the court of the Prince Archbishop, and at the time, the players in the orchestra, there were some very accomplished violinists, and there was a great appreciation and indeed a demand for violin music. So it was one of those things where all the different forces came together, and come what they are, come with the man. And luckily for all of us, that was the case, and with these stand for us still today. So focusing in then, Tomás, on the three that we're hearing tonight, being performed by Biskrida from Latvia, numbers 1, 2, and 3. It's number 3 is the one that has really, from 3, 4, and 5 are the ones that are now in the standard repertoire, you might say. So 1 and 2 would be considered to be perhaps a little lighter, less complex in form and so forth. But with regard to, he became a very accomplished violin player himself, even though apparently in an ensemble situation he would be more likely to play the viola, and then later in Vienna he played an awful lot of piano work. But I was in conversation there recently with Roy Goodman, very well regarded, very well known musician who's played right across all the genre. He plays harpsichord, he plays violin, he's worked as a conductor, he's done Baroque music, classic, 20th century music, everything. And he was saying that even though we don't have, you know, we might wish for a recording, wouldn't it be great to hear what it would be like, you know, to have Mozart playing something? He said we can get a fairly good approximation because his father, who was really a journeyman player, was a very good teacher and wrote a great textbook on violin playing and violin technique, and it would be from that that he taught his son Mozart, Wolfgang Amadeus, and we still have that. So we have some approximation, could we call it a facsimile, I'm not sure, as to certainly how he would have been taught and therefore how he might have sounded and played these pieces that we've got here tonight.
Which I think is extremely important, because the problem again, and I come back to Amadeus because it really is the shadow that looms over all of the work of Mozart since then. It really has, it's perverted the work of Mozart and our impression of him. Because like all of these versions of history, they rework the person in the image of their own time. And what we like to see is, you know, we're very interested in seeing the erratic genius and the person who's getting this wild inspiration. Now, that's very important for Romanticism, and it's very important for Beethoven. It's very important for what comes next in philosophical and political developments in the 19th century. But at this period in the 18th century, when he's writing, we're still in the era of patrons. We're still churning out music as work. And as you say, for people who are looking for a violin piece, and they come down and they tap on the door and they say, we're paying your money and we want 3 more of them, please. And that's why we see them.
So just set that then in historical context, Tomás. We're talking pre-French Revolution. We're talking around the time of American independence. What was happening outside of his musical circle?
Well, I mean, again, another part of the problem is that we superimpose a great deal of what was happening around him onto him. He is definitely a product of the previous era. He's a product of the Ancien Régime. Now, happening around him, of course, you've got the French radicals already meeting and conspiring. You know, Rousseau, we're ramping up the idea of naturalism, the idea of social and human rights, individuation, as they say. And that idea of self-determination is around him when he's writing the symphony tonight, Paris Symphony. This is 1778 when he's writing the Paris Symphony. So the self-determination has happened across the waters in America. It hasn't happened in Paris. And so when people look back and they look at the angst and the emotion and the revolutionary sort of element in this hugely popular work, of course, they're superimposing the French Revolution, which is another, you know, decade and a half to come. And so we have had no change. Yes, now Benjamin Franklin is wandering around Paris as the ambassador from this new United States, and Thomas Jefferson is amongst us, but not in Mozart's world. So I think we have to look back to the personal, his mother's death.
I think you're absolutely right there, Thomas. That's where, as you said, it was a more personal. If there's tragedy coming through in the music, it's of a personal nature. And his mother, curiously enough, had travelled with him on this trip to Paris. It was usually not the case that she usually remained at home. And of course, what he was doing essentially on this trip to Paris was looking for work. It's the most extraordinary thing that a man, perhaps the greatest genius that ever lived, spent most of his life looking for what you would call proper employment rather than commission, 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 that style of thing. He spent most of his life, he had given up working in Salzburg. He'd a row with the Prince Archbishop, and apparently he was got rid of literally by a kick to the seat of the pants by the Archbishop's steward. But then thereafter, he struggled to find what you would call proper employment. Not that it existed in the same sense as we have now with, you know, pension contributions and PAYE and all the rest of it, but that he would have something consistently coming in. When he went to Vienna after Salzburg, he was pretty successful, very popular, and a lot of money came in quickly for concerts and things that he did. But himself and his new wife, Constance, at the time, lived in fairly high style. They sent their son to a boarding school, an expensive boarding school. They took on staff. They lived in an expensive apartment and so forth. And soon they didn't put any away for the fellow years that were coming up ahead. So perhaps that was a sad aspect of it.
Now, Raymond, you mentioned genius there again. And it's one of those words that gets bandied around a lot. I suppose for Mozart, it really is one that we've begun to accept is absolutely and completely true. But it's one of those ideas, again, that is about telling us that this person was outside. It's a genius is a person who sees through everything and sees the great idea and is usually painted as somebody who is who's cutting through what is already there. And my problem with the use of the word genius within the context of Mozart is that he certainly, I don't think he is doing that. I think his music is unbelievably beautiful. The amount of music he created is absolutely, it's mind-boggling how he could have done it in such a short period of time. And obviously it's extremely popular. But a lot of popular music produced beautifully and well doth not a genius make.
Ladies and gentlemen, the floor is closed in 5 minutes. We request that you take your seats in the auditorium.
Really, what we're talking about here is somebody who is an artisan. He is a high craftsman. He learnt it. He got his chops, as they say in America, by doing the circuit and perfecting this.
Okay, Thomas, but I'll have to hold you back there. There's no doubt about it that almost all his music is characterised by beauty in the first instance, I think. Whether you like it or not, I think you can say it's beautiful. Whether you approve of the way it's done, you can say it's beautiful. But to say that perhaps it was just brilliantly crafted and was artisanal rather than full-blown art, I think I'd have to hold you up there and draw you to the operas, because there's an underlying darker current there which shows, I think, a great understanding of human nature. even the characters he created in his operas, leave the music aside, leave everything aside, even the characters that were created in a literary sense could stand compare with some of Shakespeare's. So I'd have to say, yes, the music is beautiful. There's no doubt about it. I think one of the phrases used to describe it was mesmerizing sound. There's absolute beauty there, beauty beyond belief. But there's something, there's a darker undercurrent in a lot of the later works, certainly.
Well, I think I've hit the raw nerve I was hoping to hit.
Oh.
Because isn't that really where his genius is, that he paves the way for the romanticism, the naturalism, the outsider hero, the brooding presence. And it's the operas are a brooding presence casting a shadow over the rest of his work that draws us in. And it allows us, in fact, to give way and accept that what seems a little light and delicate, there must be weight behind it, because, of course, we know he has this weighty side too. So tonight's programme, the weight comes from off stage. And then, of course, you use the word beauty, another red rag to a bull.
You used it first.
I thought it was you. There's fighting talk for the 18th century. What is beauty? Is beauty the reflection of nature, the perfect reflection of nature, or is beauty whatever we find that is given to us and not something we can create ourselves?
Just give me a second here, Tomas, while I get up on my high horse. What do you think Mozart would have defined beauty as?
Ah, well, there now is the rub. He is looking at a conception of beauty as being symmetrical, as being elegant, as really being part of the world as a clockwork engine. And it's really romanticism that comes along and says it's all about violence and mood swings and so forth. So what we see tonight is this is the tick-tock perfection of the Swiss clock.
I'm interested to see as well tonight that, as far as I know, André Rieu plays on a Strad violin, but I know for certain that our soloist Biba Skrida does play on one, which has been lent to her by the famous violinist Gidon Kramer. Now, it's worth pondering, Tomas. This violin was made before Mozart was born. It was made in 1734. It's way out there. And these instruments, they, at about 300 years of age, they're still producing magnificent sound. And I've been lucky enough to visit a violin maker. I've spoken to people who've got, I remember an Italian cellist who had a beautiful Strad cello, insured for $5 million at the time, this was about 10 years ago. These things, the violins particularly, they're featherweight. They're extraordinary, tiny pieces of equipment. You just look, a few flimsy pieces of wood, a few strings, and you can hear a sound that can fill a concert hall. And it's extraordinary also to contemplate the fact, not a word to be said against modern violin makers, and some of them are excellent, but these have yet to be surpassed, and some people think they never will be surpassed. And they seem to have just, people say perhaps it was in the water, indeed. Some people say that it perhaps was in the water that was used to make the varnish or to season the wood. There are all sorts of theories, but these are magnificent instruments. So even that will be something to look forward to here this evening.
I think there's even another legacy where we can have a physical engagement with Mozart.
No.
I'm afraid there is.
Tell
Mozart
me.
Kugel, chocolate balls.
I'm sorry?
Everywhere I go, I land in an airport in Europe and Mozart is staring out at me from the front of a series of chocolate balls. Mozart Kugel is a huge, it's absolutely huge, Raymond. There's small balls, large balls, but they've all got Mozart on the front of them. And they are in packages, they are on the lips of every traveller, and they're in the suitcases of every other traveller. They're coming to Salzburg, they may hear some music, they may buy a CD, but they'll also be popping in a pack of Mozart chocolate balls.
Ladies and gentlemen, all doors are now closing. We request that you take your seats in the auditorium immediately.